This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
TMI from the CEO. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
New trend from the C-suite, bosses who share their private lives, like the one who offered $100,000 to an employee who could find her a husband.
The class of 2018 is preparing for life in the real world after tossing their caps at graduation. Hear what today's young adults expect from an employer.
Do firms like Facebook and Google have so much of our data that the government might take them over? Hear for potential nationalizing them.
And a moment of reckoning for baseball in the Sunshine State.
Now, baseball has been in the state of Florida for 25 years. Came to Miami in 1993, went to Tampa Bay area in 1998, and it has been essentially a failure from a business standpoint for that entire time.
Ouch. Wall Street Journal baseball writer Jared Diamond on the struggling state of baseball in Florida. He's here later in the hour. Well, President Trump wins high approval ratings from Republicans and has unified Democrats in opposition. But the reactions to Mr. Trump are masking important divisions within each party. New polling reveals the voters and policies that have divided the Republican Party into two wings and the debates that will shape the party's future. Here's Wall Street Journal polling editor Aaron Zitner. Aaron, what are we learning?
Well, we, survey the American public about every 4 or 6 weeks. This is the Wall Street Journal, NBC News, national poll. And over the last 6 or 8 months, we've been asking people in the Republican Party this question. Are you a Republican who mostly supports President Trump, or are you a Republican who mostly supports the Republican Party? And we found that that segments the party very neatly into two pieces, a group that very strongly supports the president and a group that supports him weakly or opposes many of his initiatives, which really takes issue with his personal qualities and character. And you really see that the Republican Party in some ways is two parties in one.
Right. All right. So where they stood apart on various issues, for example, were what?
Well, first of all, if you ask people in the party overall, do you approve of the job that the president is doing, you get overwhelming support. You get 80-some percent of Republicans say, yeah, we approve of him. But beneath that headline number, there are a lot of divisions. So if you ask Republicans, do you support the Dreamers and the DACA program that protects these people who came to this country illegally as young children, the Trump Republicans want to kill off the DACA program by a net 24 or 25 points. The party Republicans want to preserve the Dreamer program by like a net 33 points. If you ask Republicans, immigration, globalization, do they strengthen the U.S. or do they weaken the U.S. economy? The Trump Republicans are skeptical of immigration, much like the president. They say that immigration weakens the U.S. economy by a net 30-some points. Party Republicans say immigration strengthens the country by a net 34 points.
Wow.
Data do not usually lie down this well. You don't usually get this kind of segmentation among different groups in a political party, and it just shows that you really do have a Trump wing of the party and a wing that, in the primaries probably supported Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush or someone other than Trump, the old establishment wing, which was more supportive of American engagement abroad and of decorum and norms in politics. And we're seeing in this polling that these things still exist today.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal polling editor Aaron Zitner. He's written a comprehensive piece entitled How Trump Unites and Divides the Republicans. Ultimately, this comes down to, right, what's it mean at election time, whether it's the primaries now or the midterms in November or perhaps a Trump bid for a second term?
Absolutely. So two things that are important in this divide. One is we found that this Trump wing is paying close attention to the election. 71% in our last poll of Trump Republicans said they were paying very high attention to the election. It's the party Republicans, those who are only weakly supportive of the president, who seem to be at risk. Only 45% of them said that they were following the election closely, which is a pretty low number.
Wow. Are these numbers likely to change much, or are these seemingly locked in?
Yeah, they might change. But one thing that has struck us all along about the president is, given how volatile events are, I mean, every week we're talking about some dust-up with a foreign leader or the White House correspondents' dinner or some aspect of the Russia investigation. Amid all that volatility, the president's numbers overall are very, very stable. His approval rating in Wall Street Journal, NBC News polling has gone up and down within a very narrow six-point range. Mm-hmm. And even the so-called generic ballot, that's the question you often see cited as a barometer of the race for the House of Representatives. It's where we don't put any candidate name in the question, but we say, do you think that the next Congress should be controlled by Democrats or controlled by Republicans? Or sometimes we ask, would you vote for the Democrat or the Republican in your district? It's a generic Republican or Democrat we're asking about. In our polling, those numbers are very stable, too. And so my guess is that there's more stability in people's opinions than volatility.
Thanks, Aaron. That's Wall Street Journal polling editor Aaron Zitner. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 most improved state for business, Michigan. Contact MichiganBusiness.org today. CEOs have long led with swagger, preaching about their successes and keeping their insecurities, failings, and intimate moments out of public view. Now, in some offices, the image of the polished boss is starting to fade as chiefs find that bearing it all, even the bad stuff, can be good for business. Wall Street Journal management reporter Rachel Feinsig spotted the trend. Rachel, wow, what's up with this?
Yeah, I mean, we have these CEOs who are kind of sharing it all, the good and the bad, talking about how they have imposter syndrome, how they feel like they don't know what they're doing on the job, sharing really personal stories with employees, with investors. I mean, it's definitely, you know, not happening everywhere. We still have a lot of traditional CEOs out there, but it's a trend that I started to notice in my coverage of executives.
Does this mean it's necessarily younger executives who are doing this?
That's a good question. It's something I thought about because I did find a few CEOs who were doing this were young, but some of them were older. I mean, the CEO of Cooley, which is a law firm, you know, was kind of your typical CEO in a more staid industry, and he's not, you know, particularly young. So I don't think it's necessarily a millennial trend. Hmm. It may have started with younger CEOs. It may have started with tech, but I think it's kind of spread beyond that at this point.
You can't even pin it down to certain industries, huh?
No, it's really widespread. Like I said, a lot of this cultural stuff usually starts with tech and then kind of goes from there. But yeah. I was surprised and intrigued to see it, like I said, in industries like law and retail.
Yeah, it's funny. You open this story with this woman who shares so much, right, about like she was throwing up at Burning Man, and then she said she'd pay somebody $100,000 if they could find her a husband. I mean, that's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, she is super, super open, but she says that there's like a business case behind it. You know, she says like if people feel they know me, they're going to give me more money. And she also told me that she does it because she doesn't want investors like expectations to run too hot. She doesn't want to be like the number one company in their portfolio because she doesn't want to disappoint people.
Wow. How about that? So do you think that's something that folks like her have been taught, or is that instinctual? You know, did you learn that in graduate school?
I think it's instinctual. I mean, I think that there is more talk about CEO authenticity. Like, I think that these are concepts that people are thinking about when they think about leadership today. I think CEOs have to be more accommodating and kind of tone down the power a little bit because of things like activist investors. So I think it's all on that spectrum. But I think for these CEOs, it really comes from inside of them. I mean, a few of these CEOs told me, like, look, this is just how I am. Like, I don't really know another way to be.
How about the guy who took over like that the plus size clothing change, and he said something to the employees like, "I'm the least qualified person to be here." What was that about?
Yeah, I mean, he, you know, didn't have much operating retail experience and went in and, you know, the company was in a bad spot and was basically like, please tell me everything you know. Like, I need to learn. Can you help me? And he says, like, it really encourages collaboration and new ideas. And, I mean, the employee that I talked to there seemed, like, really happy with his style.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal management reporter Rachel Feinzig. She's written a great piece entitled "Now Emoting in the Corner Office, the Oversharing CEO." And there was someone in your story. Is it Brené Brown? She made that TED Talk on vulnerability.
Yeah, she's said kind of like the vulnerability queen.
Yeah, she said you have to have a clear intention why. So you can't just go spewing stuff, right?
Yes, her point was like, don't go just sharing willy-nilly, like especially in an office setting, you have to have a reason and be doing it, you know, for a clear purpose, you know, in terms of developing people or, you know, moving something forward in your organization.
What about crying? Does that go too far?
I feel like crying is a whole other story that I like probably should write at some point. But yes, I have talked to CEOs, not for this piece in particular, but who cry in front of their employees. And, you know, I think it is an extension, like we were talking about this whole authentic leadership movement.
Yeah. So interesting. You use the word movement. Does this definitely see it that way? This is not limited to a handful of folks. It's growing.
I think so. Like I said, I see the movement as like authenticity and openness and people wanting to feel like the CEO isn't just sitting in some ivory tower. I do think like younger employees especially are demanding that. So I think that's the movement. I think these folks are maybe on one end of the spectrum, but I think they have a lot to tell us about kind of where this trend is going.
Thanks, Rachel. It's Wall Street Journal management reporter Rachel Feinzig. If social media companies like Facebook need to be regulated, how much is too much? Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the tech advisory firm, the Enderle Group, envisions a scenario where companies that hold that much of our data are actually nationalized. Rob, explain.
Well, certainly, I wrote it during the time when the congressional hearings were ongoing with regard to Facebook, and a lot of the senators were clearly very upset about what had occurred. Remember, we had the majority of the Senate were in those hearings, which was unprecedented. Yeah. And there's a fundamental sense that information, of course, that Facebook has monetized, for the most part, doesn't belong to them. It belongs to us. So there is that problem you've got when you're selling something that you really don't own, and then the practice that you have has created a national crisis, in this case, an election that may have been or likely was compromised. And so you put those two elements together with Congress needing to act, and the probability they might look at the stuff that both Facebook and Google sells, your information, and say, you know what, if anybody should control that information, and it's not the individuals, probably should be the government. And if we control that information and it's our information, then maybe we ought to own Google and Facebook. In fact, jeez, not even a big stretch. If you look at the fine that Facebook could be hit with for violating their consent decree, it's actually in the trillions of dollars, which is more than the assets that Facebook currently holds. And while it's unlikely they're going to be hit with a full fine, you know, if that happened, if it was you or me and violated an agreement like that, it wouldn't matter if we couldn't afford it or not. The big companies get a special pass. But in any case, on paper, Facebook right now belongs to the government until the actual fine is levied. So it's not as big a stretch as I initially thought when I wrote the piece.
Wow. Well, you said the information doesn't fundamentally belong to them, but might they argue that we as the consumers gave it to them?
So the government is in a place to protect us from decisions that otherwise we might be free to make. And giving up your information, if it results in compromising the democracy, would certainly fall within that venue. In other words, we are not allowed, either accidentally on purpose, to create an insurrection against the government. Hmm. So the elements, I think, are there. And given that this use of personal information has kind of relegated us, rather than being customers, we're kind of products for Google and Facebook, which has led to a rather massive amount of abuse. There's actually a book on this called Technically Wrong. It goes into great detail about how these companies are abusing us as customers and users. You get the sense that government's slowly coming around to the idea, granted they're not the most tech-savvy group on the planet,
right,
but they're coming around to the idea that all these citizens are being abused, and all these citizens are voters. And most importantly is they don't think the government really likes the idea of having a resource as powerful as Google and Facebook that could be misused against the government. And so the so those things together would tend to lead you down a path that at the very least they would heavily regulate them as utilities, and at the most just nationalize them and say, you know, maybe this interconnection between people should be something the government manages, as opposed to allowing the potential for a foreign government to do the same thing.
So you touched on it a little bit there, maybe like a utility, but how could Congress act here, how would that fly?
Well, so really it would come down to who owns the information, and the easiest path would be to designate personal information as a national resource. I mean, if you think about it, the average salary of a Facebook employee, I think it's $204,000, way above the median average, and their product is you. So clearly what you're giving them in exchange for what you're getting is massively profitable. And that's your stuff. And they're clearly not providing you anywhere near the return on that information that they themselves are getting. And so for government, clearly has a budget problem themselves. They would just claim that this information, much like a lot of the oil reserves and natural resources in the country, actually belong to the government, and it's sold off to companies who then use it and then resell it. They could claim that this information is not only their information, but it falls underneath heavy regulation and control.
Rob Enderle, tech advisory from the tech advisory firm, the Enderle Group. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit michiganbusiness.org. Thanks for being with us. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koshenka with you. Coming up this half hour, what the class of 2018 wants from a potential employer. Also, a moment of reckoning for professional baseball in Florida. And can Liverpool rescue English soccer on the world stage? We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, here's a real rarity on Capitol Hill. Members of Congress who give birth while in office. The latest to do it, Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth. More from This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
The number of new mothers in Congress is still minuscule, but growing. Jennifer Habercorn of Politico has interviewed a number of them about the challenges they face and is here to tell us what she found out. Jennifer, what kinds of numbers first are we talking about?
So in the 229-year history of the Congress, there's only been 10 women who've had a baby while they've been in office. The first one was in 1973, since then there's been 9 others.
So what are some of the challenges that these women are facing?
So there were several themes that came up. I spoke with 9 of the 10 women, and they said, you know, that in general people were very supportive and very excited that they were having children, but the reality is that on Capitol Hill, it's just very unusual to see any lawmaker have kids because there's a lot of difficulties in juggling being a lawmaker and being a parent. For instance, there's no real maternity leave policy. There's nothing really set in stone. Lawmakers typically decide on their own what they want to do. And in general, most lawmakers only ended up taking a couple weeks. I heard one instance of someone taking 2 weeks, another of about like a week before she was back at work, not full time, but back at work.
Jennifer, recently we saw a somewhat dramatic picture of Tammy Duckworth rolling in a wheelchair with her baby into Congress. What about her situation?
Yeah, so that was what kind of got me interested in this topic, because Tammy Duckworth was the first senator to have a child while in office. Most of the lawmakers who have had children have been in the House, but she was the first in the Senate, and you know, Tammy Duckworth had a situation in which, you know, she was injured in Iraq, so she's in a wheelchair, and she now has a baby. And because of that combination, she wouldn't be able to vote if she had her child with her, because children are not allowed on the Senate floor. she couldn't even go into the Senate cloakroom and kind of wave her hand out the door while she held her baby because it's not wheelchair accessible. And she was able to change those rules, though. So now children are allowed on the Senate floor. And Senator Duckworth, before she had her baby, told me that she doesn't plan to do this a lot. She doesn't plan to sit there with her child. But in situations where she's just voting for a couple minutes, she wants to bring her baby so that she doesn't have to worry about handing the baby off to someone.
We're speaking with Jennifer Habercorn of Politico. Jennifer, what about the scheduling problems? Congress is often called in to do something on a moment's notice.
Yeah, if you remember, you know, there's situations where there's been a threat of a government shutdown and they are voting at 11:30 at night and it's very last minute. Usually in those situations, people don't know when the vote's going to happen. And I heard several stories from lawmakers about how they've had last-minute babysitting problems. Representative Sanchez told me that there was a vote once at 11:30 at night, and her husband was out of town. She was home with her baby, but they had to vote. And she's like, okay, well, I either need to, like, wake up my kid and bring him to the Capitol or, you know, do something. So she knocked on a neighbor's door, and the neighbor was able to watch her her child. But it was just kind of one of those things that every working parent has run into problems like that, but very particular to Congress when, you know, there's an 11:30 emergency.
Jennifer, there are more women running than ever in the midterm elections. Do we think things will change as women start to populate Congress more?
Yeah, you know, that was a hope that I heard from every single woman that I talked to for this story. They really hope that there's more women who run for office and more women who are having children at the same time, kind of making their own decisions on their family for themselves. And actually, I spoke to one potential member of Congress who is running for office, and she's due on Election Day, she's expecting, with twins. And so she kind of was joking with me that God has a sense of humor, putting all this in her lap at once. And she said, you know, she hasn't really figured out what she would do if she is elected and how she would juggle everything, but that it would work out.
How about that? That's Politico's, or rather, this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Politico reporter Jennifer Habercorn. It is 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. If your company is in hiring mode, do you know what today's new college grads are interested in? LaSalle Network, a national staffing and recruiting firm outside Chicago, has published its annual report on what the upcoming graduating class wants in a job and company. Here's what's in it from Tom Gimbel, founder and CEO of LaSalle Network. Tom, what have you found?
Well, the big thing is an overwhelming majority of the kids graduating, we surveyed over 3,000 seniors in college, and the overwhelming majority had not accepted a job yet. And the reason that that's interesting, that in years past you'd have that number would be maybe at least 50%, if not greater, had accepted a job prior to the middle of the second semester senior year. And what we're seeing now is the economy is so strong that kids are realizing that they can hold back and really field their options.
Wow. So, you know, go back to the title of the report. It made me chuckle. What the class of 2018 wants. They get to call the shots, because I thought it might read what employers want and need from the class of 2018.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting choice of words. I see where you're coming from. And where it is, when unemployment is at 3.9 or 4%, it really becomes a little bit more of an employee market. And right now, as there aren't a lot of more seasoned, experienced employees that are willing to make moves, you see that companies have no other choice but to rely on kids coming out of college. So looking for what they want can really focus on employers. So the big phrase that's come up over the past half decade or so is employer branding, and that companies now have to market themselves externally as a great place to work, as a fun environment, as a career advancement opportunity, where in decades past it was you went to General Electric or you went to a big bank because you knew you had career progression and you could grow, and 15 years from now you'd be making a lot of money. Today it's saying, if all things are being equal, here's our brand and here's what you'll be a part of. And that's what kids want to see coming out of college.
Wow. We're speaking with Tom Gimbel. He's the founder and CEO of the staffing and recruiting firm LaSalle Network. All right, so where does growth in an opportunity rank compared to, say, pay or health benefits, 401k, or, you know, pool table or something?
Yeah, so the two big ones, the top two, over 50% of the respondents believed, were culture and compensation, right? And so we saw compensation creep up into the top spot, which hadn't been there for a while. And what that says is, number one, not as idealistic as in years past. Number two, that kids coming out of college are believing that we are in a recovery and money is more accessible. And number three, and I think it's kind of a reflection on, without getting into a huge political conversation, that what's happened in D.C. is that it's okay to say you want to make more money again. And the tides have shifted a little bit due to some of the direction coming out of D.C. So people are saying, yeah, I want to make more money.
Thanks, Tom. Tom Gimbel, founder and CEO of LaSalle Network. 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Baseball trouble in Florida when the newly christened Tampa Bay Devil Rays starting selling tickets for their 1998 debut season. They threw a party outside their St. Petersburg ballpark with players on hand to greet fans and sign autographs. They sold out exactly one game. About 15 years later, the Miami Marlins finally built the stadium after a long battle, signing a crop of big-name free agents to mark the occasion. Then tickets went on sale, and the Marlins didn't fill the seats for their series against the Boston Red Sox, an opponent with large support in South Florida. Wall Street Journal national baseball writer Jared Diamond says the 25-year baseball experiment in Florida has not gone according to plan. Jared, not good news.
No, it's not. And now baseball has been in the state of Florida for 25 years. Came to Miami in 1993, went to Tampa Bay area in 1998. And it has been essentially a failure from a business standpoint for that entire time. Both teams have struggled to draw fans for virtually their entire existence. They have not done all that well on the field either in most of their seasons. And it sort of raised questions about whether baseball can survive in Florida, a state where you would think there'd be a lot of interest in baseball. Spring training has been in Florida for 100 years. There's a lot of baseball talent that comes out of Florida. But so far, Major League Baseball has been just a big mess, and it's sort of this blight on Major League Baseball at this point.
What are the reasons that baseball struggles, at least professionally, in Florida?
Well, they're two different situations, Miami and Tampa Bay, and I think people try to conflate them and want to conflate them, but they're not actually the same thing. You know, Miami has been kind of a mess from the beginning. They've had four owners now in 25 years, which is incredible volatility, and there's a lot of distrust from the organization and the fan base who have been burned so many times from owners who have dismantled the team, who have traded away talent, who have not seemed interested in putting a competitive team on the field. Plus, there's this whole business with the Marlins Stadium, Marlins Park in Little Havana in Miami. The way that was built has been very controversial in terms of the public money that was taken and used to build it, and that has really caused a horrible relationship between the Marlins and South Florida. Now you have Derek Jeter and his ownership group in there trying to clean it up. We'll see how that goes. In Tampa Bay, another situation involving a stadium. They desperately need one. Their stadium, Tropicana Field, is generally considered to be the worst, or at least one of the worst stadium situations in baseball. It's in a terrible location in St. Petersburg instead of in Tampa. The traffic's terrible. It's really hard for people in Tampa, which is sort of the centerpiece of the Tampa Bay area, to get to the stadium. They believe to succeed they're going to need a new one in Tampa instead of St. Pete, but there's a lot of questions about whether that'll ever happen.
Wow. What about, you mentioned the story, and I never considered it, transplanted fans from other regions of the country, possibly the Northeast, who just have allegiances elsewhere and are not supporting these teams?
That's been a big problem with all sports in Florida, not just baseball. The fact that so many people who live in Florida aren't from there. Most aren't. Most of them have come with their own sports allegiances from wherever their hometown was. And that's why you see, with a lot of Florida sports, big crowds for the visiting team. You know, visiting team fans come and fill up their stadium. There's a lot of people traveling to Florida. They'll buy tickets to see their team. You see that a lot, especially with football in the middle of the winter, where football fans from the Northeast will fly down to see their team in Miami or Tampa Bay or Jacksonville, even, because it's a chance to escape the cold. So that's been a problem with all sports in Florida, and it's no different for baseball. You go to a Rays game against the Yankees, and it's mostly Yankee fans. It's just the way it's always been. Same with Marlins-Mets games. A lot of Met fans in Marlins Park. Well, not a lot. There's never a lot of people there. But the ones that are, mostly Met fans.
Well, that story. Wall Street Journal national baseball writer Jared Diamond. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. The English Professional Soccer League, known as the Premier League, is generally considered to be the best soccer league in the world. It's also the richest, with 14 of the 30th wealthiest clubs on the planet. But the performance of English teams on the world stage has not been good lately. That said, Liverpool has a chance to change that when they face Real Madrid in the UEFA Champions League final May 26th. Liverpool, by advancing this past Wednesday, is the first English team to make the final in six seasons. As 538.com says, a seemingly bottomless pit of cash to spend on players has not translated into success. Yet the wealthiest club in the world, too, Manchester United, has not had anywhere near the level of recent success that some of these super clubs have, as they're known. Manchester United has reached the quarterfinals only once in the past six seasons. The European super clubs, Barcelona, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, have dominated recent editions of the Champions League. In fact, Real Madrid is gunning for its third straight UEFA title, led by superstar Cristiano Ronaldo. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.